Hello everyone, and welcome to today's webinar and our first webinar for 2021. So my name is Mitchell Bowden. I'm the Manager of Engagement and Impact within the Knowledge Translation and Impact team here at the Australian Institute of Family Studies. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we're meeting. In Melbourne, the traditional custodians are the Wurundjeri and the Bunurong Bunurong peoples of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders past and present, and to the elders from other communities who may be participating today. So today's webinar is going to be a little bit different in that we're running our last webinar from 2020 again, Families and Food, Identifying and Responding to Food Insecurity. But we're adding in some role plays to provide examples for practitioners working with families who may be experiencing food insecurity. The catch is that we won't be having a live Q&A session today, but the upside is that all the questions from last year's webinar are incorporated into this broadcast, and the transcript and links to the recording are all available as well. So for a quick recap, in 2020, CFCA did a deep dive into food insecurity. We produced a research paper looking at what the data tells us some of the different experiences of food insecurity in Australia can be, a practice guide for professionals working with children, families and communities across a range of different settings. And this guide gives strategies and tips on how you might identify people who are food insecure and then what supports they might be linked in with. And then a short article on the experiences of food insecurity for Australian women and children affected by domestic and family violence. All of these resources are now available on the CFCA website and on the event page for this particular webinar. The presentation you're about to watch contextualizes food insecurity first as a public health concern, then through the experiences of on-the-ground professionals and services providing emergency food relief, and then finally, from the perspective of practitioners working with families experiencing food insecurity in other health and social services. What we've added to today's webinar are two examples, role play examples, of how practitioners can include questions regarding food insecurity into a session with a client. Firstly, when a client may present with health or social needs, or when a client might present explicitly in need of emergency food relief. So I'm now going to hand over to myself to continue introducing today's presenters.
Today we're joined by Dr. Sue Cleave, a senior lecturer in public health and nutrition at Monash Uni. And she's also the convener of the Australian Household Food Security Research Collaboration. So Sue's research focuses on the existence and experiences of food insecurity, strategies to prevent it, and pathways out of it. She's also an accredited practicing dietitian with over 20 years experience in health and community settings. And also Sue and a couple of her colleagues from the research collaboration worked with us on the paper and the practice guide that I mentioned earlier. So welcome, Sue.
Thanks, Mitch.
The general manager of business and at Food Bank Australia, our next presenter, Sarah Pennell, oversees Food Bank's research portfolio, which includes the annual publication of the Food Bank Hunger Report. For those who aren't familiar with these reports, the most recent edition has some really insightful findings on the impact of COVID-19 on food insecurity. And we're going to touch on some of these today, but you can also find the report on the CFCA website and Food Bank's website as well for later reference. So hi, Sarah. And lastly, Margaret is part of the assessment and response team at Gippsland Lakes Community Health, focusing on child first, family violence outreach and intake. She's a social worker with 15 years experience in national and international settings working with children and families, including working abroad in child protection services, in managing an alcohol and drug prevention service, and working with culturally and linguistically diverse communities and facilitating national prevention initiatives and workforce development. So hi Margaret, welcome to you.
Hi everyone, thank you.
So now I'm going to hand over to Sue, who's our first presenter, and she's going to set the scene for us with a bit of an overview of what we know about the link between food and financial hardship. So over to you, Sue.
Thanks, Mitch. Hi, everyone. So before I start, I'd like to acknowledge the people of the Kulin's Nation on whose land that we're all meeting today. And I wish to pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging. So in this very short space of time, I really want to go through kind of like a bit of a what we know, what we need to know, and what do we need to do. But as a starting point, there's a couple of key points that I want to stress on, which is certainly available in the papers. So one is around our definition of food and nutrition security. So in essence, it's about regular, reliable, physical and social economic access to enough food that's nutritious and culturally relevant to meet dietary and needs and food preferences. And because this is a basic fundamental human right, we also need to ensure that it's acquired in a socially acceptable way. So that's without resorting to emergency food supplies, scavenging, stealing, and other coping strategies. So it's really important there's key elements to this definition that are around that support, I guess, our direction of our responses. The other point that I want to make is when we hear statistics around food insecurity, that quite often we can't compare apples with apples. So it's really important that we consider, you know, how the data was gathered, who it's specifically looking, what was the tool that was measured. So we do know that from representative surveys by the ABS, so the Australian Bureau of Statistics, that approximately 4% of our population are experiencing food insecurity. But for many of us, we know this is much higher. Other measures, again, of a representative sample are around 13%. But we know that in some groups of the population, it is significantly much higher than that. So with that point, it's also important, and this is some evidence that's come out of Canada, that it's also really important that we look at, measures around or reports where, you know, statistics around usage of food relief, that they don't become proxy measures of household food insecurity. Because what we do know, and I'll talk about in a moment, is that it really can underestimate the actual number of people experiencing food insecurity, because it's really capturing those who are at that point of needing to source food relief. So we're essentially missing a large number of population who may be experiencing this issue. And this is really important that we, from our policy-based responses. So the next thing that I really want to touch on and to draw your attention to is that food insecurity can have, well, there are many faces of food insecurity, and there are groups of our population who are at greater risk. But certainly what COVID and other, you know, experiences that we've had in Australia, including bushfires this year, et cetera, have really exposed more faces or more Australians to this experience. But also what is seen as really highlighted the inequities that do exist in our country. So what does the experience of food insecurity really look like? Well, in short, it's kind of like this continuum of experience that, is going along in a severity. So what we do know is that what is seen as perhaps the milder version is about stress, anxiety, concern about putting food on the table, consuming perhaps less or inexpensive, less nutritious choices, making changes to the quantity and quality, skipping food, skipping meals, and then that severe experience of hunger, running out of food, unable to afford more, can't put food on the table, and reliance then on social supports and or emergency food relief. So people can actually slide across this continuum. So it may not necessarily be a static experience, and they may be showing more than one of these experiences. The other thing to highlight is that this can be an episodic, so at different points in times for households and for individuals, it can be chronic and ongoing entrenched experience that people may be you know, caught in this cycle for many, many years. And then there can be what we call the cyclical kind of experience, where it may be associated, say, perhaps with a certain time or point in a particular month when pay comes in, but then there's also a range of bills, etc., that come in as well, so that it becomes this cyclical experience, whereas the episodic may be related to, say, for example, a bill shock, as an example. So this is well documented, this kind of range of spectrum of experience that can really happen. And certainly this spectrum of experience, you know, I've certainly seen when I've talked to many people around this experience that, you know, certainly that stress and anxiety is core to this experience as well. The next part for us to consider, and I won't go into a lot of detail around this apart from one element, and that's around the determinants or stresses of food insecurity. And in the paper on the website, it goes through what are kind of like the key dimensions of food insecurity, and one of those being, so those being around food availability, access and utilisation, but the stability over these of time. And I think what we would, with stability, that includes things like pandemics and natural disasters, which we are certainly experiencing at this point in time, and the natural disasters being things like bushfires and floods. So what I really want to focus on is what is the key driver of food insecurity. And that is certainly linked to financial resources and material hardships as well. So while there is this inverse relationship between food insecurity and income, using income alone as a potential marker is not necessarily as sensitive. So it's really looking at things like, as I said, financial resources, asset to debt ratio. There's literature to describe that if households have savings up to a couple of months, that can be in there, can actually be enough as a temporary kind of protector against the experience. But what things like, you know, income shocks, insecure employment, casualisation of employment, as I said, bill shocks, large household bills, something, you know, everything comes in at once, can certainly tip people into this experience. Now, in Australia, I think probably Jeremy Temple from Melbourne University, he recently looked at some representative survey data by the ABS, and in particular, one around the general social survey. And what he really focused on in this analysis was looking at the stresses reported by food insecurity status. And what he highlighted within this, it's also things like health, so illness, mental health, but also things that impact on financial resources. So around not able to get a job, loss of employment. But the other thing here, which I think is of interest and relevance to the paper that Mitch mentioned earlier, is the experience of violence or witness to violence, as also a key determinant. And the other thing here is that quite often it's these determinants or these stresses that are stacked together that significantly impact on food insecurity. So with this, Jeremy Temple also looked at things like our social assistance payment. And it was really an interesting piece of work here, which he highlighted that, again, looking at something, data around the called the Household Expenditure Survey, highlighting that those who are on student benefits, so OSS study or AB study, disability support pensions, and at this point in time when this analysis was done, it was still called New Start. So as we know now, it's called Job Seeker. Those people who are on this form of social welfare are significantly at a much higher risk of experiencing food insecurity than those that are on the age pension. So this was really important data for us here in Australia to hear about. So that's kind of, I really wanted to set the scene, is that these stresses and around finance are significant tipping points for households. So what has happened in the light of what we've experienced in 2020? And I think what has certainly has we've seen is that food insecurity has worsened within economically vulnerable populations under COVID. So loss of income in already low income households really puts them at much greater risk. But what we've also seen is households who were not previously seen as economically vulnerable and previously food secure now tipped into this experience because of income losses. And I think early on we were seeing that households who had this suddenly had this heightened experience of economic vulnerability were then drawing on sort of finite, unstable resources such as credit, so using credit cards and superannuation to help to support their household expenses. So this then also creates certain issues with that as well. So what do we know? I mean, is there any data? Well, there's one particular study during COVID that's happened in Australia that is currently in the literature, and that is by a team from University of Tasmania led by Catherine Kent. And what this group were able to show was a representative survey across Tasmania, and what they were able to show was this gradient of impact that was apparent for respondents who lost income as a result of COVID, where if an income loss of 25% or more significantly increased the odds of food insecurity. And what they did find is that independent of other factors, including household income, a loss of more than 75% of income was associated with around a sevenfold increase of risk of food insecurity. So what has happened in terms of response? And so I'm going to particularly focus on the federal responses around the coronavirus supplement and the JobKeeper and the JobSeeker. So what has this meant for households? Just as another example, there's been some work by Mandy Lee and Merrin Lewis from University of Queensland. So using a tool that actually measures the cost and affordability of food, and you can actually look at it for a healthy diet. Now, previously we know that anything that it's across a standard basket of food, that affordability, anything around 30% of income for is deemed as being unaffordable, and food stress at around 25% of income. So what they were able to show using this basket and showing the impact of some of the federal responses to the coronavirus was that actually potentially made the access or the economic access to healthier food slightly more attainable by and shifting people from that let's say that food stress and really having difficulty to afford it to potentially being able to afford it. And this was also supported by some recent work by Australian Council of Social Service. So ACOS prepared a report where they highlighted across a number of factors the impact around the coronavirus supplement across a number of people receiving social welfare. And what they were able to show was this measure really enabled people to purchase nutritious food. They were able to afford fresh fruit and vegetables. You know, prior to the supplement, 60% of those surveyed, and we're looking just under 1,000 people, reported that they didn't eat fresh produce and were skipping meals. And so it's shown to make significant changes, particularly around people's access to food, in particular fresh fruit and vegetables as well. So that's really just as a highlight of what we've seen as a measure and what has happened. And I think what we'll hear through the rest of this webinar is potentially around things that what we can do across working across this sector. But also I think it's for all of us is our role as advocates around key things that are really going to make a real difference around not only importantly the prevention of food insecurity, but also in terms of bringing people out of this long-term, you know, potentially a long-term experience. So that's it from me. So thank you, Mitch, and I'll hand over to Sarah.
I'm going to corroborate a lot of what Sue has already said to you. I have been listening, and a lot of what she has already highlighted has come through in our own research. I work for Food Bank. We're the largest food relief organisation in Australia, and for the past 8 years, we have been producing a hunger report, basically taking a look at food insecurity in Australia. In 2020, that report is somewhat different to previously, because obviously the year has been very much a year of two halves. And at the time of doing our research, the 6 months of COVID had really kind of thrown everything up in the air. And so our research this year has just looked at the COVID experience rather than being a general snapshot of the whole year. So what I can say is that food insecurity in the time of COVID has been very erratic and unpredictable. That said, overall though, on average, demand for food relief has been up by about 47%. But at different times, that figure has oscillated between up nearly 100% to then down to below 30%. And that's all been around what's been happening with things like government support. So as soon as the coronavirus supplement and JobKeeper and JobSeeker kicked in and people had money in their pockets again, those people that had sought food relief for the first time when ISO hit and people lost their jobs, they were able then to manage for themselves. But that said, since September, when the first rollback of the support started, we have seen demand for food relief climb again, and in fact up a further 28% since the end of September. And talking to charities, they believe that they're going to see double the number of people over Christmas than they did last Christmas. And they have even greater fears for post-January, when there will be further rollback of the support, but the government support packages. So we at Food Bank believe that we actually haven't seen peak hunger in this COVID pandemic. We believe that the economic recovery phase is actually going to be far more of a concern when it comes to something like food security. But let's unpack the kind of people who have been experiencing food insecurity during COVID. And what we're seeing is that there's a number of things going on. First of all, those people who were previously food insecure, so those who had been experiencing chronic food insecurity, have suffered even more. And I think Sue mentioned this. What we've seen is that those Australians who were already seeking food relief before COVID are now actually seeking food much more frequently than previously. And in 2019, it was about 15% of those seeking food relief sought it more than once a week. And now we're seeing 30%. The other group is a completely new group, or a completely new variety of groups. 3 in 10 of those experiencing food insecurity during COVID had never experienced it before. And charities are seeing a significant number of two particular groups. One is casual employees, and the other is international students. And I think we're familiar with that because there's been quite a bit of media about international students. And in the case of both groups, it's largely because they are ineligible for the government support. Another point I wanted to make is that a higher proportion of people experiencing food insecurity for the first time during COVID are women. So about 60% of all those people experiencing food insecurity for the first time are women. So while the government assistance such as JobKeeper and JobSeeker have provided vital temporary relief, 62% of food insecure people say they are not receiving all the assistance they need. And a fifth, as I've said, are actually completely ineligible for the assistance. Another trend that's worth noting is that it's the young Australians who have been hardest hit during COVID. When it comes to experiencing hunger because of the pandemic, young Australians are the ones at the forefront. This is reflected in that 65% of food insecure 18 to 25 year olds are going without food at least once a week. That is significantly more than any other age group. Amongst baby boomers, for instance, it's only 25%. The other thing I wanted to mention is there are grave fears for the future. We asked food insecure people to look forward, and almost 35% of them said they don't know whether they will cope or expect that they won't cope when the additional government support is withdrawn. Charities believe that demand will increase over Christmas, as I've already said, and then again when the assistance is rolled back. And they are telling us that they would need at least 50% more food in order to be able to cope with the demand. Sue made the point that we shouldn't use numbers related to people seeking food relief as a proxy for food insecurity, household food insecurity. She's absolutely right. What we've seen in our research is that 61% of food insecure people actually access food relief, which means about 40% aren't. And when we unpack that, what we find is there's a variety of reasons why they don't, but quite often those reasons are relate to embarrassment and shame. And this is the case under normal circumstances, but even during COVID, when we know that everybody's being affected equally, and you know, genuinely people could not have predicted that they were going to lose their jobs in the way they did overnight, as happened during the lockdowns, they still are not keen to reach out for help, but believe that, you know, it's embarrassing or it's their fault that they don't have the wherewithal to put food on their table. So that's a big issue and one that we really need to address. That's all I wanted to share today. I know we're going to have an opportunity a bit later to take questions, but I'm now going to hand over.
Thank you, Sarah and Sue. I work in East Gippsland, which is in regional Victoria, in Gippsland Lakes Complete Health. And what I will do during this time is focus a little bit about the clients we are seeing and the problems they are presenting to us in our practice. So in regional Victoria, we have experienced first the drought and then national disaster of the fires, the bushfires that started the year, and then the pandemic. So the clients that are presenting to us are very, very much hit in the financial situation because of the pandemic, because of COVID-19, because of resulted in less income, lack of income, and also lost jobs. So if they maybe had part-time jobs that was giving them a little bit more income, stability in their lives or in their families, now they've lost even that. It could be a full-time job, but even those who were relying for a little bit extra income. Many of them have lost that resource as well. So what they present like are sometimes occasional clients. So sometimes they come because occasionally they're experiencing food insecurity, and this might be because of an accident, an extra medical bill that they have because of something happening in their health, or else their car breaks down and it's an extra expense that they did not foresee, you know, and other situations like that, which is not their usual pattern. So they experience just a one-off situation where they're really struggling. And then they come to us and say, look, I'm really struggling, can you help me? And they might ask for food, which can be quite embarrassing for them, especially if they have been managing before. But we also have others who maybe are experiencing food insecurity because of other underlying issues. So sometimes there could be an addiction to substance abuse or even gambling that is leading them to mismanage their funds and putting maybe the funds in the wrong priority, and then they don't have funds for the food. Or else, on the other way, they might be focusing on prioritizing food for the family or for themselves, but then they are neglecting bills, and then they end up having difficulties with paying their rent, and sometimes they risk eviction. So the problem of food insecurity is not part and parcel on its own. There's usually other complex issues around the food insecurity issue that they present. Sometimes there's family violence situations as well, and so the person that needs to leave the family violence environment has to seek alternative accommodation, and that can be an added strain in the finances. Sometimes they cannot access their finances for a while as well, and they present to us, but that would be again an occasional situation. I think as professionals, sometimes we are a bit reluctant in exploring the financial situations with clients. We might have, from a professional side, we might actually feel that we should not probe in that area because it's a private matter. However, we have noticed that when we have clients who have presented asking for food regularly, it has been very beneficial to sit down with them and actually explore a little bit what's happening in their finances. So we do ask those probing, uncomfortable questions of, when is your Centrelink due? How much income do you actually get? And what has happened during these last 2 weeks? Where has your money gone? But of course, in a very sensitive manner, so that the client does not feel intimidated or closes off to give us that information. But by asking those questions, if we ask it in a sensitive way and in a caring manner, the client might actually be in a position to open up about other issues that they need help with. They might be able to be linked into counseling. They might be able to be linked into specialized services for addiction, for their addiction issues. There might be family violence that comes out through that conversation, or other abuse situations that is occurring that is leading to the financial instability and need for food insecurity. So it's really good to have that question and do it in a very sensitive way. So we sometimes focus on assessing the big problems. So let's say if we work in child first, we want to work with parents and we want to address parenting skills and the other issues around the parenting. However, if a parent is struggling to put food on the table, sometimes if we manage to actually address that need before we address the other bigger problems, the client might be more inclined to open up and receive our suggestions. Because if you are a mom, for example, and you cannot provide food for your children, that is the biggest problem that you need to be tackling before you are tackling anything else. So clients seem to appreciate when we actually address financial instability and food insecurity as one of our assessment things that we assess. So they really appreciate that and sometimes open up to want to receive other things as well, other services and other supports. I think it's very important as well for organizations and for social workers to be aware of non-government organizations around their agency that provide food. So if you're working within an agency where you do not have food packs to give to clients, you can actually have resources around you that you can link clients to or liaise with. For example, we do that in our work. We have a non-government organization that provides us with food bags for clients, and we make sure that they are food which is specifically for the need of the client. So whether it's a homeless person or whether it's a family, the needs for food might be different. If somebody doesn't have a house on their head, they might actually still need food, but they won't be able to cook that food. So we need also to be aware of our clients' needs. And we can only be aware if we do those conversations with the client. If a client comes and we just give a food bag and not dwell further, we might be missing out opportunities to be able to reach out to those clients. So it's very important that we tackle that issue, maybe to think about also sensitively including food insecurity as part of our assessments with clients, and also to be aware of clients that present to your agency and the different situations that they come from and how that might be leading to the food insecurity. So that's all from my part, and I hand over back to Mitch.
Thank you. Thanks, Margaret. And equally, thank you to Sue and Sarah so far. And that's a really great segue, actually, into the next part of this webinar, where we are actually going to look at this idea of screening or incorporating some sensitive screening questions into your existing intake or assessment forms, or even if you're not working in a client-centered way, even just in some discussions that you might be having with communities or individuals or families. So we are going to look at some of those things. And first, I might just ask Sue to come back on. And she's going to, I guess, just give us a quick overview of what screening questions are available to us. And these are available in the practice guide that I mentioned earlier, that's on the website and also available in the handout section. But don't worry if you don't have it in front of you, because Sue's gonna just quickly introduce those to you and tell us why they're important and how they can help your clients.
Great, thanks, Mitch. So I think, you know, the first question, I think, Margaret, you know, the segue has been fantastic, because why screen? It is really important, because one of the things that we haven't touched in, but it's really well described within the practice papers, is food insecurity ultimately has impacts for both adults and children in the short term and the long term around physical, social and mental health as well. So it is really important that we do actually screen for it and have those discussions. So what can we use? So in the practice paper, we actually have a tool that has been relatively newly validated, and it's built on a tool from the US, from the US Children's Health Watch, and it's called Hunger Vital Signs, and it's a two-item screener. So a team from Queensland University of Technology, so Danielle Galagos and team have actually taken this tool and done some preliminary validation of this with some modifications in an Australian context. And so they've done this within a paediatric healthcare context and as well as in a regional context in an outpatient kind of setting while people were waiting for appointments. And what this tool really does, I think, you know, you get the picture that across our presentations, this experience, as we've talked about, is not just about that end stage of experience, about running out of food, not having enough money for food, but it's also centered around that worry, concern, stress around, will I run out of food before that we're able to buy more? So these are essentially the two screening questions, and these can actually be built into your assessment that you're doing with clients or as people as you see them, so that they can actually be threaded through the conversation. And yes, there is stigma, and I think that's something that we have all alluded to around food is something that, you know, we all, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that, you know, people have, you know, particularly parents and particularly mothers, there's that stigma and that shame of, I don't want to say that I can't feed my children, or, you know, we're really struggling with food. But the question can actually be asked, particularly as a starting point, is, you know, have you ever been worried about that? And so in terms of this screener, we've got those two questions there. And they're, and in responses, it's been phrased as something that's never true, sometimes true, or often true. So if we get people who respond never true to both of those questions, then they are on the continuum as what we would describe as they're food secure. But I guess the thing is also to highlight that these are screening questions and an assessment of whether the people are at risk or potentially experiencing. For those that may then respond sometimes true to either one of those questions, then certainly they may be at that, if we think back to that spectrum, perhaps on that the early stage or some of the earlier kind of experiences where people may not be progressing further up to that continuum, but certainly is serious, you know, potentially at risk of progressing further. And then there's often true where people are responding to both of those questions. So they would be described as certainly if they've said, responded to that they've run out of food in both of these highlights then of these questions, then they are certainly deemed to be experiencing food insecurity and on that continuum, more that severe sort of spectrum. So I think the thing is both these questions can be threaded through and the assessment and threaded through the conversation when we're facing clients that and as Margaret sort of mentioned that, you know, food insecurity is really potentially a marker of a range of multiple stresses that are going people are experiencing in their day-to-day lives. So I think now we're going to go back to Mitch and then we'll talk about those in more detail.
Thank you, Sue. So before we head back to the panel, this is where we're going to show you our two role play examples. And again, these are of practitioners incorporating screening questions into discussions with clients, either as clients presenting with emergency food relief needs or with other health and social needs.
Hi, thank you for coming in today for the appointment. I called you to come in today because I wanted to talk to you about a referral from Child First that we've received, suggesting that you might need support.
I don't understand why I'm here.
Okay, and I understand you can be a bit confused because you wouldn't know who has done this referral. Is that what worries you? So basically, we've received a referral saying that you have two children, is that right?
Yes.
And that you have mental health issues and you might be struggling a little bit about that.
Can I ask who your referral was?
It was an anonymous referral, but they said that you have kids and you have mental health and that you might be struggling a little bit and some parenting support might help you.
I'm really uncomfortable with that because, you know, normally people get involved and causes problems, and I don't want anybody to take my children away from me.
Can you tell me a little bit more what you mean by it causes problems and the children be taken away from you?
I don't really want to share my personal life with anybody.
Okay. Have child protection ever been involved with you?
No.
No. And what do you mean by you're afraid that children would be taken away from you?
Well, when people start asking questions and they get involved in your life, accidents can happen, things can go wrong, people can make bad decisions.
I understand your fear, but what I can reassure you about is Child First role is different than that. So Child First aims at trying to give you support as a parent to actually care for your children. We don't have the authority to remove your children. That is something Child Protection can do. We do, yes, feed back information to Child Protection if we feel there is the need. But if we do that, usually we discuss that with you and we explain that we are concerned. So our aim is not to actually contact Child Protection and say how bad a parent you are, but actually it's to try to empower you as a mom in whatever struggles you have at the moment for your kids. Does that mean anything to you?
Are these people parents? Well, themselves? Like, I mean, I think I'm doing a pretty good job. I'm trying to do a really good job, just under really difficult circumstances.
Yeah. Whether the professionals that work with us are parents or not, it's not important because they give the same support to any parent. So they won't do decisions for you as a parent. We also understand that you as a parent are the best person can take decisions for your family. So it's not about whether they're parents or not. I believe they can still try to understand you if you allow us to give you support. But it's something that is voluntary. This is not something you are forced to engage with. It's something that can be an additional support for you if you want it. I'm not sure. Okay, so let me give you a bit of an understanding of some of the services that we have here. So there's a lot of services like counseling, parenting supports, family violence outreach supports, services for the children and young persons. So there's a variety of services that we offer as an agency. But I'm actually going to ask you something that some families that we encounter struggle with quite regularly with, which might be something that you might also consider. Do you worry about your food? Do you have food?
Always.
So you feel that financially you struggle?
Mm.
Okay. And that's okay to discuss even things like that, because they're day-to-day struggles that you might have as a parent. So even basic things like that we can discuss. So you're saying that you worry sometimes about food. What's your situation like this week for you?
Really difficult. I don't have a lot of money. I'm not working. And with the two children, with the baby and my five-year-old, I have to choose and make choices on a weekly basis between, do I buy formula and nappies for the baby, or do I feed my five-year-old? And I don't eat myself. I don't.
And that's really concerning that you're not eating, because you need to take care of yourself as well as taking care of your children. And I believe that can be quite stressful for you.
It is very stressful. I've got some other issues myself personally, and not eating makes it worse.
Can you tell me a little bit more about these other issues?
I have postnatal depression, which I struggle with, and I'm diagnosed, but I'm not taking medication because I can't afford to pay for the medication.
I understand. So this financial situation is affecting you in many different areas in your life, both in your parenting, it seems, and also in your mental health. Providing you with some food today and some food vouchers to buy some formula for baby help a little for this week?
I'm not Australian born, and in my family, a mother who can't feed her children isn't worth much.
I understand.
And I can't talk to my family about that for that reason.
I'm sorry about that. You don't have support from your family. What I can tell you, although I'm not from your same culture and I wouldn't pretend to be an expert as well, because you know your culture well. But what I can assure you from our side is that we offer you privacy and confidentiality, and your family or relatives do not need to know that we've provided you with food.
I need to make sure that's really important to me. They can't know that I've, because as a mum, you know, I feed my children, I feed my family, I take care of them. If I can't do that, they'll look down on me.
Yeah. And you're not the only mum that struggles with providing food for your kids. We are meeting a lot of families who are struggling at the moment with providing food. So it's not because you're a bad parent, it's a reality of the current situation. And I really actually appreciate that you voiced your concern with me, because at least we can do something about it. But going back to what you told me about your family, I can reassure you that they cannot phone and know what services we're giving you. And also, you don't need to tell them where you brought your food from or that we're giving you food vouchers. Because I understand it can be sensitive for you, and we respect you for that, and we respect that you've been able to share it with us. And if you allow us, we'd like to help you with that.
Okay, thank you.
Would you accept food bags and food vouchers from us today? Would you want that?
Yes. Okay, good. Thank you.
We can also look a little bit on the long term to see how we can avoid this worry being something that is repetitive of not having food for yourself and your kids.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe look at how that is affecting your mental health if you allow us to offer you support with Child First.
Okay.
Is that okay? Do you feel a little bit better than how you started this appointment?
I've never reached out for help before, but I'm glad that I came in today, because it sounds like you might be able to help me.
Okay. I will be calling you again, and would it be okay if I come visit you at home? Is that something more easy for you?
Yes, if we can arrange a time when there'll be nobody else around, I'll
definitely
appreciate that.
Okay. Yep. Thank you for being so honest with me. And we can assure you that we'll be very sensitive in how we provide you support.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, how are you today? How can we help you?
I'm good, thank you. I've just come in today because I'm hoping that you might be able to assist me with some food, because we don't have any left.
Okay, so how many people are in the home?
It's myself and my partner and our two children.
Okay, how old are your children?
One's two, one's five.
That's good. And you're saying that you're finding yourself this week having more food?
Yes.
When is your next payment? Do you have a job? Do you have something?
No, I lost my job. I work in catering, and we receive Centrelink payments, but it's been, I think we were paid last week. We've got another week to go.
Mm.
And it's really difficult to try to keep on top of everything. And I'm just hoping they might be able to get some food.
Yeah, we can help you today. We do have food bags and food vouchers that we can help you with. It's just I'm trying to understand whether this is something that occurs often, and whether you actually find yourself worrying about not having food for yourself and for the family regularly.
I do, but there's nothing much that I can do about it, because, you know, having lost my job, it's very difficult to pay the bills and the rent and sort of keep everything going. I have to prioritize and choose which one to do.
And does your partner work, or is he also
No, he's also on Job Seeker as well.
Okay.
He doesn't work.
And how does it go? Like, do you have other expenses that you are finding yourself struggling financially with?
We've got the real estate agents on our back at the moment, because we're behind. We're getting into arrears. We're about 3 weeks in arrears, and they've already threatened us that they're going to evict us.
And that would be quite stressful to think about.
Oh, it's very stressful, very stressful.
Mm-hmm. So you're 3 weeks behind in rent, and when is your next Centrelink payment?
Next week.
Okay. And did you plan to try, do you have a plan on paying back the rent somehow with the agents, or have
Well, it's very hard to have a plan when you don't know where your next dollar's coming from.
Of course, I understand that. So yeah. It's like you're juggling every week, isn't it?
Yeah, all the time. Yep.
Okay. We do have food bags and food vouchers that I provide you mm-hmm. with today. I'm just concerned about this that you called threat about addiction, which mm-hmm. is very concerning as well. Would it help you if I try to see if we've got some funding to try to help you with the rent that you've got in arrears? Maybe you can find your feet a bit financially.
I'm really worried about my husband finding out that I've actually come here, because I think he might be a bit too proud to accept that kind of help and assistance.
Okay.
So
okay.
That's something if it's something you can do, then I would probably talk to him about it, but I wouldn't talk to him first.
Yes, definitely. You can talk to him about it and let me know whether we can help you with the rent and arrears. Look, we have a lot of support and services here. Do you think there's something that we can provide you and your partner with that can help you maybe understand what the problem is that is leading to this financial struggle, apart from you not having a job?
Well, when I get another job in catering, it won't be as hard as it is now, because obviously I'll have a wage coming in. And it just, we're not spending a lot of money on things that we shouldn't spend money on. We're spending money on rent and food and things like that. But my husband has a bit of a drinking problem. He's, he buys a lot of alcohol, and that money goes towards the alcohol rather than food for the kids, because we've tried to keep up with the rent. Then we pay the rent first, but still 3 weeks in arrears. But, you know, he's drinking. I mean, he doesn't help much with the kids either, so that makes it even more difficult.
And I see that you're expressing quite a bit of pain as well about that, because you seem to be concerned about your children and maybe you feel that he's not seeing the same priorities as the same as you.
No, he doesn't.
So I'd like to give you an appointment, because I'm aware that today you dropped in and asked for the food, but would you be able to come and have a bit of a more chat with us, so that we can see whether we can offer you supports, like you've said, and maybe also your partner, you know, if he wants support with his alcohol issue, eventually we can give him support as well, if he agrees.
I don't know that he would agree, but I would appreciate being able to come back and see what you can do for us.
Yes. Maybe giving you a bit of support in these struggles, and also trying to understand, you know, what's going on, because I see that you're a bit in pain. Maybe we can understand what happens when your husband drinks, and whether there are other issues that we can give you support with.
Okay.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Kim and Margaret. So now we're going to head back to the panel discussion and the Q&A session with all of our presenters. I might ask Sarah and Margaret to join us again. And really one of the things that has been touched on throughout this presentation, but I think is worth exploring a little bit more as a panel, is this idea of stigma and shame. So in the practice guide, people will find that there's a series of FAQs, or frequently asked questions, that we've attempted to respond to try and overcome some of these. And one of them I'm keen to discuss as a panel, and that's, as a practitioner, if I was to not feel sure about asking these questions, because, you know, I know my clients get uncomfortable and I worry that they might feel judged or embarrassed, you know, do I really need to include this in my intake? And what should I do if I do notice that, either in their verbal responses or in their non-verbal cues, if I do notice that they're starting to feel uncomfortable, or that they're indicating in their body language something that might indicate that they are feeling food insecure, but their verbal response is saying, no, I'm fine. So Margaret, maybe could we get your perspective on that first, being that this is something that you're familiar with in your practice?
Yeah, so I think we need to be sensitive. And of course, although we want to probe to actually help clients, I think fundamentally it has to also portray care, and that as an organization we can identify the specific needs so that we can offer the support. So that message needs to be highlighted. So we cannot just do like a tick tick box kind of questionnaire with the clients to find out whether they have food insecurity, because it is an embarrassing topic and it's not a topic that clients will just gladly admit to unless they are willingly coming to ask for food in their first response. So we need to be sensitive, probe, but also walk with the client. And if they don't feel comfortable, then we need to be able to stop and just see whether there are other resources that we can offer instead, that might actually release some funds for them to be able to then tap into food resources for themselves. So either we could, if they present, for example, with an issue, I don't have fuel or I don't have a gas cylinder, etc., we can offer them food to release finances from the food expenses so that they can use that funds to use it for the other presenting issues that they've presented. And that sometimes leads to a more comfortable conversation of, oh, wow, thank you. Sometimes I have had these challenges. Or else if they present wanting the food specifically, then it's more comfortable to have the conversation of understanding more about the income and what's happening if it's a repeated pattern. So we need to always show care in our approach, of course.
Sarah also, maybe Sarah will go to you first. Did you want to add anything to that?
I would just add from another potential approach is to just ask them about their shopping habits and how well their kids are eating, you know, what kind of meals do they do at home, what do they give their kids to take to school. So you start asking from that positive perspective, and then you know, where they're experiencing difficulty or challenges in having enough food, it'll start to come out. But you don't start with that. You just talk about, you know, having to cater for a, you know, a growing family and how challenging that can be, and work towards it, towards those, that greater understanding.
Yeah, great one. And what about you, Sue? Anything
yeah,
to add?
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, it certainly is tricky, but I think it's also too, as we've sort of said, it's having that respect and coming with that care and that empathy. But also, I think in how we approach the question, so it may not be, we can sort of perhaps frame it of, you know, I come across lots of my clients who talk about, you know, this is an experience and you know, really struggling at times to put food on the table and, you know, provide school lunches or, you know, as an example, that can, you know, is this something that, you know, you're experiencing or you've experienced in the past? So it's taking away from that specific also focus on that individual and also saying, look, hey, you know, I've come across this, see, you know, with lots of people that I speak with and work with too.
You're not alone.
You're not alone, because I think that is a really good point. There is that sense of I'm a failure. This is what I'm you know, my experience in speaking with people in terms around their experience of food insecurity, particularly women, there is that sense of failure, because I think, like as an example, one woman I can clearly remember, she said, "This is my job. I'm meant to be able to feed my kids, and I can't do it."
Yeah, wow.
Another response that we get quite frequently from our surveys is people saying, yes, I am struggling, but I'm sure there's other people who need it more than I do.
I agree, Sarah. And I think that's that sense of that people will hold on and struggle, and perhaps, you know, as you sort of said, there's a whole group of people that are not, may not seek support or even support from family and friends.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is definitely this importance of the rapport building and having a good relationship with your clients. And that, and you know, and that may be difficult if you're not always working with the same client, but I think it's probably as a service organization worth considering. You know, there's these questions. Yes, they've been validated, and yes, we know that they can lead to good conversations, but it's worth it's worth thinking about where in the process with people that fits, whether it's at the point of intake or whether it's maybe a little bit later on and in various discussions at, or through inquiry it comes up.
I think also they might actually be thankful if we ask the question. They might not have actually thought that they could ask that question. Maybe they're not aware that there's the resource or that the possibility of asking us that question. So they come to us for something else, maybe for counseling or other things, and they might not identify that they can actually speak about food insecurity with us as well unless we ask. So they might actually be very thankful that we have actually put that forward.
So powerful if you do, because not having the stress or concern about food in the household can free up time and energy and hope for addressing the other more fundamental issues, you know, that have brought them to that circumstance. So the charities that we supply food to are always telling us that the food relief that they do provide is just so critical in building trust and giving people the capacity to address their other issues.
We've got one other one that we might get to in a little bit, but I do want to go to one of the questions that's come through from the audience, which I think is a really interesting one. And so it's, as a local government or community development worker, or public health promotion type of a role, how can we best support stakeholders to deliver food security initiatives and build capacity of individuals and groups in the community to increase their access to healthy and nutritious food through gardening, food banks and seed sharing and things like that? So I think it's really around, again, that notion of not working in a client focused service, but how can we work as a system? So Sue, maybe did you have some perspectives on that firstly?
Yeah, I think I think what they're, you know, implying and leading to is that systems thinking. So really applying within that local system, that local government context, that broader system of food access. So looking at it quite broadly, so inclusive of perhaps food relief, but beyond that. So what are other things that within that local government and within all the, you know, the myriad of organisations that sit within local governments and community-based organisations and the connections. So I think that's really important, that to provide a very much joined up but a very varied response to actually support access to food. And, you know, even within a local government context, like the power that they potentially have in terms of even looking at, well, what are the, you know, the access points for people in terms of food? So what are the fresh food outlets? Where are they? Do we have adequate public transport? Do we need transport, you know, transportation system to help, you know, if it's that food physical kind of access kind of point that we're doing as well? Yeah, so it's really looking at that system.
Yeah.
I think, Sue, the big issue is that while food insecurity touches on so many areas of policy and you know, welfare response, be it social welfare, health, education, employment, you know, it touches on all these areas. But it doesn't sit in one area, and so it falls between the cracks. And I think one way of being able to get a better, more systematic approach, as Sue said, is to have, be it at the local government level or, you know, right up to Commonwealth government level, have a food security strategy. So actually look at food security in totality as it spans across all the other portfolios.
Mm. I think that's a good point.
It's interesting. This touches on the point that Margaret, you made earlier around, you know, if you're not in a position in your organisation to be providing food vouchers or food hampers, or even running community meals or lunches or things like that, you know, doing a little bit of that mapping of who else in your local system is doing what in relation to food. Or like Sarah said, it may not be that they're working in food at all, but they're working in employment services or education. So that actually links to this next question that we've got, which is, given that the main drivers of food insecurity are related to financial resources and material hardship, for those professionals and organisations that are responding to food insecurity, so this might be our emergency relief or charity organisations, who should they be working with? So who can they, if they're starting from scratch, who can they be reaching out to identify and work with? So Margaret, did you want to maybe give your thoughts on that first?
Yes, so we have actually linked with a local church in the community that wanted their initiative to be providing food. So they don't actually meet the client, they just do meetings with us and organize food packs for us, which is great. So they provide that through their funding and they're reaching out to the community through that. And of course, that provides us with resources to give to the clients. So I think it's very important to just keep a really wide perspective about where actually resources can come from, because we might be focusing only on a few organizations that we know, but there might be other voluntary organizations also that would be willing to work with us to resource the clients.
Yeah, yep. Sarah, did you want to add any of those? So you're nodding avidly.
Yes, I mean, Margaret's absolutely right that help can come from all sorts of sources. And COVID was an amazing example of that for us at Food Bank, because COVID first hit, a lot of charities, the normal regular charities that we were supplying, closed, because they had older volunteers who needed to isolate themselves, or they found it too difficult to adapt to the COVID safe protocols, changing perhaps from cooking hot meals to providing hampers was too difficult for them. So we had to reach out to others to help. And the response was overwhelming. We had everything from local footy clubs actually delivering hampers for us, commercial companies whose reps were off the road, they actually offered the services of those reps and their vehicles to help us, you know, deliver food to new places, people who were in lockdown and therefore couldn't come and get the food. Rotary service groups all dived in. It's amazing once you have a plan, how many people will step up and say, I will help you with that plan.
Yeah. And I think also building networks with other professionals in other organizations. For example, last week we had a local hospital social worker working within a local hospital who contacted us because they knew that one of the services that we provide was actually food for clients. And they had a client who was being discharged and he was homeless. So they wanted to provide food vouchers and food packs for them. Mm-hmm. So they've linked, it wasn't our client, but we could work together like that to provide the resource for that service to provide to the client. So I think we need to be really aware of the networks that we can build with other professionals as well.
Yeah. We're probably going to have to wrap up soon, but I also wanted to just add neighbourhood houses and community centres are a great pick-up drop-off point. And there's also the Ask Izzy website, which you can actually go to and visit and search for a range of these different things. And that's on the webpage for this webinar. All right, so we might jump back into the practice guide now and look at one of the other FAQs that we tried to respond to. And this is really around, I guess, working with people from different cultural backgrounds. So my clients can be from Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities and or from a range of overseas backgrounds, including people seeking asylum and refugees. So when I'm asking these screening questions of them, is there anything I should be aware of? Do I need to use any particular language? And is there anything else to consider? So Margaret, I know you've done some work in culturally and linguistically diverse background communities. So did you want to answer that one first, and then we'll see what Sarah and Sue want to add?
Yeah. So although food, of course, is a universal need, so everybody needs food regardless their background. However, there are some backgrounds and different cultures that for them food is not just a food intake every day because their body needs it, but it's also around bringing the family together and having a social event and inviting extended family over and providing quite an abundance amount of food. And they feel that there is that expectation that they need to meet as well. So sometimes they might feel more embarrassed as well to say to their extended family that they do not have that food provision to provide, because it's not just about the daily needs, but it's also meeting that social expectation and the social event that is part of also the culture. In cultural and the diverse and linguistically diverse communities, there's also the sensitivity of ensuring that the communication is actually not misleading and that they're actually understanding your point of where you're coming from, where you're asking about food, because it can be, you know, in different cultures, it's different. So they might feel that that's something that they should not open up to you. They might feel more comfortable to address it with a person of more that is more aware of their cultural background. So we might need to, maybe if we are working with somebody and we're not aware how our questions might impact or how we're going to address food insecurity because they're presenting it, I think it's very important for us to seek knowledge from expertise who work with cult communities or with Aboriginal communities who can give us tips on what the client is presenting and what their actual need is, and how best to address it. So we might need to maybe address the client to a specialized service, or else just receive enough information for ourselves to understand presenting problem and the surrounding issues as well in regards to the culture.
And I think also, I guess I would also just always encourage the use of interpreters and not always using, and where possible, and not using family members. Because we can't necessarily always guarantee the quality of the translation that's being done, or whether there's they're answering truthfully because of the stigma that's attached with this kind of an issue. So, Sarah, did you want to add anything to that one?
I could just add that our 2019 research, we did some analysis around Indigenous communities and found that, not surprisingly, very high levels of food insecurity, much higher than obviously the general Australian population, and higher levels of psychological distress around that food insecurity than is the case elsewhere. But one thing that is noteworthy is that a higher proportion of Indigenous people do seek food relief. Not to say that they're successful in getting it, but they're more likely to actually seek help than people in the cities, other areas. So just some observations.
And Sue, anything lastly to add?
No, I think I really concur with Margaret's point in terms of, you know, how that approach and, you know, that understanding of the role that food has and that pressure of, you know, certainly in perhaps family celebration situations, it's not like bringing a plate, it's potentially the expectation for that household to provide everything and the pressure that does put particular people under, and I think also in cultures of that notion of within family of that sharing and what is mine is yours and what is yours is mine as well is important to note too.
Yeah.
I think it's important also to note that if we're working with cult communities, we need to also be aware of their religious backgrounds and not offer foods which might actually be disrespectful to their practice. Mm. So yeah. We need to also be sensitive and do a little bit of a research about what we're actually offering them, not to actually disrespect their practices.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point, Margaret, and comes back to that whole definition and consideration of how we respond in this situation, that it is culturally appropriate foods that are being provided.
And I guess I would just summarise that conversation by saying that, you know, by reminding people that are listening that we're not expecting, no one's expected to be, you know, a cultural expert or to be, you know, an Aboriginal liaison or a liaison worker in order to do this work well. And I think it's probably just there's probably some cultural competence building that can be done quite easily by liaising with your local Aboriginal controlled community controlled organisation or working with the migrant resource centres and that are nearby. Or even reaching out more broadly beyond your local area, just to get a sense of what are the key things I need to know, so that I can be confident to ask these questions sensitively. I think the other question that's come through from the audience is just around and on a similar note, the idea of food insecurity in regions versus major cities. And I think Sarah touched on that before, but I was wondering, Sue, whether there's any research around, you know, rural and remote areas and the experience of food insecurity.
Yeah, I think in answer to your question, yes, there is, Mitch. And certainly there's that ABS statistics highlight that those that live in regional and remote Australia may be experiencing food insecurity more perhaps than those in, you know, larger cities. The reasoning certainly can be the same, but, you know, there are some differences. So if we think about Australia, we're a big, quite, you know, country where, you know, there's aspects where there's, you may live in one town that may not have a store where you can access food and you need to drive 2 hours or more or to the nearest food store to access food. So there's that physical access to food, and it's whether people actually have physically, they have a car, they, you know, can afford to put petrol in the car to, you know, that sort of thing as well. But then also we know the cost of food as well in regional and remote parts of the country is significantly greater as well. So there's also that physical access, the cost, as well as statistically, you know, the median income is potentially lower in regional parts and remote parts of the country than, say, living in, you know, major cities as well. So there's similarities, but there's also some clear differences as well that add to this complexity as well, and then certainly the response too.
Yeah. Yeah, Sarah, anything to add from the Food Bank Hunger Report work that you've done?
Yes, so another aspect of this is, Sue's absolutely right, our research also shows that there's a higher level of food insecurity in the country areas. Not surprising with, you know, recently with things like drought and then the black summer, just to add on top. The other thing is people in the country experiencing food insecurity are more likely to experience stress, depression and shame. There's a pride there that when they're unable to support themselves, you know, really knocks them for six. It does mean that it hits them psychologically harder than perhaps their fellow Australians in city areas.
Okay, and this is the sort of a last question and a closing question, and that's really around, I mean, I guess touching on the fact that this is quite a layered, complex issue. And we've talked about financial hardship as kind of the key driver, but not the only driver, and that's important to note. So I guess, so I might start with you and hear what Margaret and Sarah have to say as well, but I guess the question in closing is, what does a solution look like? What's the answer to this really, really tricky problem to solve?
Yeah. Well, there's probably a reason why it's called a wicked problem or a complex public health problem, and because there is no one simple solution. There's not one response that is, you know, one size fits all. Okay, as firstly. And that is really, as we've sort of highlighted through all of this, there is, while financial resources is the, you know, one of the primary determinants, we've got a whole range of other factors coming into play as well that provides that stress. So what we actually need is multi-strategy responses that range from a population kind of level that is cross sectors. So by cross sectors, I mean that is bringing in, you know, health, education, employment, those hot, you know, social assistance. So we're looking at that really kind of cross sector kind of policy based response. Okay, that is going to have that population level impact. Then we can, if we then go down to the other end of the spectrum, is then what we've perhaps been touching on today is more of that individualized focus. But the reality with the individualized focus, while yes, it is really important, that is not going to lift people out of the long-term experience of food insecurity. I think, it's like, and I think Sarah, you've mentioned it's like a Band-Aid, and I've got a colleague in the UK and she talks about it's like putting the sticking plaster on the wound, you take it off and it's still there. So you've kind of addressed it to a point, but you haven't completely solved the issue. And then we've got that gamut in between, you know, across communities that we can have a range of responses at a community-based level with, you know, that's really, again, multiple community partners across sectors that really then, address at that level. But we need, it's not a one size fits all, and what might fit in one community may be very different in another community, as well as what we said, you know, what might fit in regional Australia may be very different to what fits within, you know, your larger cities. So I think that's the message there. It's about multiple responses that we need, and with that, to really try and help to drive that, we need to have a much better understanding of the scope and the magnitude of this is an issue, and that comes down to having really, really clear measurement, and not only clear measurement, but one that's on a regular basis. So you look at, you know, countries like the US where it's measured on an annual basis, Canada every 2 years, UK is now starting to do every year as well, and we are stuck with like a 3 to 4 kind of
Margaret or Sarah, anything to add to that?
I just agree with everything that Sue has said. And we do understand that, you know, at Food Bank and other food relief organisations, we're just treating the symptoms. And what we need to do is you know, take a more preventative health kind of a approach where people don't get the issue in the first place.
Yeah, on a practice level, when we're meeting clients, rather than just putting the bandage on, as we're saying, but rather just exploring if they're coming with food insecurity, exploring the issue behind that presenting problem, what is causing the financial instability and the food insecurity, and because there might be things that we can actually provide solutions for. There might be mismanagement of funds. There might be mental health issues, there might be addictions, there might be other things that we can help the clients to tap into, maybe linking to a job provider if they would like to maybe find a job, if they are struggling to find a job, you know, trying to understand a bit the what is causing the food insecurity and trying with the resources that we have, supporting the clients to actually come to a better place.
And I would guess I would just say on my own reflection that I don't want to devalue the importance of the Band-Aid, I guess, and that, you know, and that based on what we've heard today from you all, the most resourceful people can still encounter an unforeseen shock and that kind of episodic food insecurity could hit any one of us at any point in time. So we could have the best systems in the world and the best population health approaches and public policy approaches, but we will always need people like Margaret at Gippsland Lakes Complete Health, and we'll always need the food banks of the world to be there for people when they fall on hard times.
And I think it's, sorry, Mitch, I was just going to jump in as kind of a last point. I think it's really also important that we recognise that to really approach this from a strengths kind of based approach is that recognising that lots of people I talk to have these amazing levels of resilience as well as, you know, skills and assets and, you know, very creative in trying to make ends meet. And as we've sort of all been saying, it takes that kind of really ongoing kind of point or that one point that really puts that stress on, you know, for that individual as well too.
I think that's all we've got time for today, so I might wrap it up there and thank you all once again for your participation and sharing your incredible wisdom and knowledge. So thank you all.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I've learned a lot as well, so thank you Sue and Sarah as well, because I really learned about from the research and stuff, so thank you.